I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The next generation of social entrepreneurs has arrived. Echoing Green is a global nonprofit organization that provides seed money and fellowships to people who create some of the most innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Cheryl Dorsey, president of Echoing Green, joins us to talk about this year's fellows, and she'll tell us why you should not start another not-for-profit organization. And we'll also talk with Catherine Von Jahn about imagining the future. She's done many projects looking at the future of work, the future of chemicals, even the future of Major League Soccer. But now she is turning her attention to the future of cities. All that plus the news from PlanEtizen coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Since 1987, Echoing Green has brought venture capital investment strategies to the social sector. The organization has found passionate social entrepreneurs and funded their work through two-year fellowships. Cheryl Dorsey is the president of Echoing Green, and the organization recently announced the 2009 class of fellows. Before we talk about the fellows themselves and their projects, which are so exciting, describe the fellowship program for me. What do you offer and what do you expect to get back?
Sure. Echoing Green runs a two-year fellowship, a grant program that actually extends into 4 years worth of services. So the first 2 years of the fellowship, we offer cash grants of $60,000 to $90,000, health insurance to allow people to leave existing jobs or leave school and be covered in terms of their benefits, and then 4 years of technical support, 5 skills building conferences to help emerging entrepreneurs launch their new social change ideas. And essentially, the fellowship is a platform that allows young visionary leaders to launch new social change organizations that otherwise they'd have a hard time finding funding for.
How do you distinguish between traditional nonprofits and what you probably see as a new breed of social entrepreneurs?
Right. And we believe that, you know, social entrepreneurs are firmly embedded within the social sector context. But we do believe that there is a slight distinction. We really do see the social entrepreneur as a unique kind of social sector actor, someone who by dint of passion, ability to execute, a tremendous focus on results and impact, and bringing a new innovative idea to an intractable social problem, that collection or constellation of characteristics, traits, and qualities, we believe distinguishes a social entrepreneur from a committed, terrific social sector leader. So I think that a social entrepreneur is just sort of a slightly smaller subset than what you would normally see in the social sector marketplace.
How do you define success for your fellows and their organizations?
So it's tough for us because as angel investors in the social sector, first of all, we invest in people. So when these young visionaries come to us, there's no there. They have talent, they have passion, they have vision, but they're just at the beginning of the trajectory of launching the social change organization. So essentially, we're placing a big bet on talent. So obviously, that takes, you know, years to play out. But, you know, we are asking them to start a new social change organization. So in the early years of the fellowship, we do track organizational development trajectory. So, for example, when you compare Echoing Green Fellows organizations with other new startups, what we find is that Echoing Green Fellows sort of outperform the typical social sector startup along a range of organizational development variables. So they raise money more quickly. They build their board more quickly. They hire staff more quickly. They're identified as thought leaders in the media in very significant ways, statistically significant ways. We see social entrepreneurs outperforming other startup actors in the social sector.
Do you think, Cheryl, that's because you've anointed them as fast-track social entrepreneurs, or do you think it's what they're learning as part of the program, or do you think those are qualities that you select for in the first place?
I think it's a little bit of everything, Carol. So, you know, again, Echoing Green believes it has a core competency, a particular ability to spot and attract this kind of outstanding talent. So we really feel like we're really good at picking these young winners, these talented young people. So they bring so many skills to the table. We also do believe the imprimatur of an Echoing Green Fellowship matters a lot. You know, close to 20 years ago, Echoing Green gave me my first significant grant to start my nonprofit organization. And the imprimatur, the cachet of being included in the Echoing Green Fellowship program, meant the difference between my phone calls being returned by traditional philanthropists and being ignored by others in my field. So it really was sort of the on and off switch and the on and off ramp to my participation in my field of choice. So I think the fellowship makes a difference, helping them get farther faster. But also, I think we really identify those young folks who are tremendously committed to social change and who are particularly talented at executing against their vision for change.
You say that you have a propensity to pick talent. You're good at that. What is it about someone you see first on paper and then I suppose you meet them in person? What is it that tells you that they have talent?
Yeah, so I do think there's something irrepressible about just deep, deep passion and commitment to an issue and a cause. And I have been doing this for a long time, Carol. You know, the passion literally leaps off the page. You can feel the commitment to an issue. I call it a wonderful obsession. You know, you read a proposal by a social entrepreneur and they're so deeply invested in every nuance of the issue or the problem that they're studying it. It becomes part of their DNA. This only becomes amplified when you meet these folks in person. You know, Echoing Green talks about a constellation of qualities that we in shorthand refer to as SEQ. It's a play on Daniel Goleman's EQ or emotional intelligence. We sort of see a constellation of characteristics that in total seem to be linked to a high success as a social change agent. Everything, again, from deep passion and commitment to a particular cause, really being results oriented, having an asset-based mentality when it comes to thinking about a particular problem. We see these folks as being tremendous resource magnets. They have a profound ability to attract people, financial resources, and volunteers and others to their cause. So this whole panoply of characteristics, when it comes together, it's really tremendous. And we often joke, you kind of know one when you see one.
Let me ask you this. Do you see any trend toward social entrepreneurs imagining carrying out their cause without a formal organizational structure or a sense that we need to create a 501c3 that will exist in perpetuity? In other words, thinking about running their passion through a campaign-like structure that has a beginning and an end.
Well, I think that's right, Carol. You know, I spend a lot of time on the road and I'm always invited to panels to talk about how young people can start organizations. And my ongoing plea is please don't start another organization. The wrong message of social entrepreneurship is to conflate success with being the founder of something. There are far too many, you know, not-for-profit organizations in this country, so many under-resourced, so many that lack capacity. The message is not about starting an organization. The message is about finding an idea, a cause that you're totally passionate about and driving against that passion either within an existing organization where you can be a terrific intrapreneur through a time-limited campaign or project, something like that. And then in a few cases, organizations like Echoing Green that really do fund people to start new organizations that allow that protective casing for an idea to really go through, you know, launch, proof of concept, on its way to sustainability. So what I like about the young people that I see coming before us, they're agnostic about organizational entity. It could be for-profit, not-for-profit, big, small, network, not networked, and they're just really more focused on results than organizational form.
Let's talk about your fellows. I want to mention two to you, and I'm sure you could pick out many, many more, but I want to mention a couple and ask you to talk about them. Bethany Henderson, City Hall Fellows, Inc. in Pasadena, California. Tell me about Bethany's idea and why you chose her.
Sure. So Bethany is a terrific young social entrepreneur who really started looking at the human capital and capacity issues of state governments all across this country. When you look at the workforce in the civil service around this country, these folks, these baby boomers are close to retirement. And it is not, I think, an overstatement to say that a lot of these state governments, these city halls, are going to be facing a crisis as this workforce turns over. Bethany saw this and saw this as a problem and thought about the idea of replenishing the pipeline of human capital with a cheap, energetic, smart form of labor, young people right out of college who really are interested in giving back in their communities. And what a great way to do it through civil service at the local, state, and regional level. So Bethany has created a fellowship program that brings young leaders into the civil service bureaucracy and infrastructure, matching them with current leaders, allowing them to learn at the side of these senior city managers and others who can show them up close and personal how it is to navigate local bureaucracies and make a difference in this very important part of our public infrastructure.
Let me ask you about another, a young man that I've had the opportunity to meet, Jacob Kolker.
Yes.
Of the Extraordinaires. Tell me why you chose Jacob.
Terrific. And like Bethany, Jacob exudes, you know, the SEQ qualities, incredibly passionate about his idea. A true content expert who understands every little nuance of the technology that he's working on. And let me just step back for a moment. The Extraordinaries is a program that is trying to create a space around micro-volunteering, this notion of being able to chunk out, create bite-sized opportunities for individual citizens like you and me, Carol, where we may not have an afternoon to volunteer at a soup kitchen or to work with, you know, the homeless over the course of a week. But maybe we've got 20 minutes sitting in an airport before boarding a connecting flight, and we've got a smartphone or some other technology that would allow us to work with an organization in bite-sized chunks, whether it's tagging photos for NASA or whether it's potentially reviewing donor lists for a local nonprofit. It is, to me, the perfect marriage of technology, social networking, and public-mindedness to bring all together to create a brand new space in terms of volunteerism in this country.
The fellowship program has been in place for more than 20 years. Can you talk about some of your successes? Where have you seen the big successes, the big gains?
Sure. So Echo and Green was founded in 1987 by the senior leadership of a private equity firm headquartered in Greenwich, Connecticut. They also have offices in Manhattan and Palo Alto and other cities around the world, General Atlantic. And these founders thought about how they could give back philanthropically after doing quite well as private equity professionals. And they really were pioneers in the space of adapting business principles and practices to the social sector. And core and key to their business success was the notion of betting and backing talent. And they thought this was a wise strategy, so why not adapt it to social change? And if you could achieve a really high social return on investment, that seemed like a smart play to them. So when you look at our track record of investing in close to 500 social entrepreneurs working in 42-plus countries around the world, 40-plus states around the U.S., a lot of people do not know the Echo and Green brand, but they certainly know some of our most successful investments. So, for example, Echo and Green was an early funder of Teach for America, probably the best known social entrepreneurial organization in existence in the country today. We were also early funders of City Year, which is essentially a domestic Peace Corps that served as the model for AmeriCorps program, the same program that President Obama just last month doubled the size of, another great success in terms of national service. Internationally, one of our best-known successes is SKS Microfinance, which is the fastest-growing microcredit institution in all of India. About 180% annual growth rate, has served 3 million-plus poor women in 20,000 slums and villages around India. It's actually a for-profit entity that's not only doing well and good, it's doing both at the same time. So I think those are probably some of the best-known examples, Carol, of Echo and Green's investment successes.
In your role at Echo and Green, you get to see some of the brightest ideas come across your desk. What do the successful initiatives have in common other than great talent
The first thing that jumps out at me is this real focus on the root cause analysis of the problem. So, for example, we're fond of saying, you know, we're not in the business of funding yet another after-school program. But if you have looked at the lack of opportunities for young people in the 3 to 6 p.m. hours after school concludes and when children can get into trouble, and you have a fairly new model to deliver those services, or you fundamentally reimagine why you're offering those services and how you're offering those services, that's what Echoing Green is looking for. And what we often say is, you know, social entrepreneurs and Echoing Green fellows are so good at reimagining the problem and shifting the problem definition that by default, new solutions arise and innovative new ways of even looking at the problem shift the framework. So that's fundamentally what we're looking for in addition to great talent.
You were an Echoing Green Fellow yourself, as you said earlier, and you've since, of course, returned to lead the organization. What was your bold idea?
I had the great honor of being funded by Echoing Green in 1992, and I started a nonprofit called The Family Van. I co-founded The Family Van with my mentor, an extraordinary obstetric anesthesiologist who's now dean of students at the Harvard Medical School, Dr. Nancy Oriol. In the late 80s, Nancy and I were looking at the issue of infant mortality in inner city Boston. At the time, black babies were dying at three times the rate of white babies, you know, a stone's throw away from the best medical facilities in the world. And it was so appalling to us that in this land of plenty where you had the best hospitals in the world, how could it be that a few short blocks away, babies were not getting a fair start at life. So essentially, we created a community mobile health unit that served as a culturally competent, welcoming, accessible stepping stone from the streets into existing health care and medical facilities. And it doesn't seem revolutionary now, but at the time, notions of health disparities, cultural competency, access to services around transportation, language, ability to pay, was not so much a part of the lexicon. So Echoing Green really believed in us before many others did. And, you know, for that reason, we'll be eternally grateful to Echoing Green. And the Family Van is still on the road, serving about 7,000 clients each year in inner city Boston.
In your time as president of Echoing Green, what have you learned about investing in the philanthropic sector? And perhaps more significantly, what's your notion of how that is sustained over time?
Right. And that's a tough call. You know, as I said, there are too many nonprofits in the country. By some estimates, you know, 114 or so new nonprofits are being formed every day.
And I know that's an extraordinary figure, isn't it, Carol?
It's shocking. And in a sector that is undercapitalized, so you've got duplicative, inefficient, overlapping efforts not getting the job done, and it's a real problem. I think that there are just a couple of very fundamental problems. The philanthropic marketplace is undercapitalized. It's not organized in any particular way. One of the problems that we often see is, you know, foundations have a particular view of the world, and they go out into the world and find organizations that fit into their existing view. Unfortunately, that's not how community problems come packaged. And what I've always loved about Echoing Green is the notion that indigenous leaders closest to their communities, closest to the data on the ground, know better than any funder ever could how to attack particular community problems and which problems should be privileged and attacked first. So I think, you know, there's a fundamental mismatch in the power dynamic between those trying to do the work and those trying to fund the work. I wish I had, you know, some sparkling, smart, aha answers and moments to provide, but I just don't, Carol. And I think it's a problem with our sector, all of these different initiatives sort of spinning and bumping into one another. And it makes for a fairly fragmented, ineffectual sector. And we've got to figure this out. You know, this economic downturn is different and it's going to be harsh. And by some estimates, we may lose up to 100,000 nonprofits because of the loss of revenue. And I think we're going to have to think smarter and do our work better, more coherently. I just think it's a discipline that will be difficult, but might make the sector a little smarter in the long run.
Well, going back to something you said earlier, have you been able to fund anyone who then did their work, did his or her work, inside an existing organization and as a result changed fundamentally that organization?
Pretty much the answer to that is no. And that...
Aha, so you're one of the culprits in starting all these new nonprofits.
Well, see, I'm very careful with that. And again, like I said, I literally start every speech saying, please don't start another nonprofit. I think you have to look at Echoing Green's theory of change to understand why we fund nonprofits. Now, mind you, we only provide, you know, 10 to 20 fellowships per year. It's not 100, it's not 50. It's a small number. And our theory is that, in fact, social change is so hard to drive, in part because you're pushing against a status quo that does everything in its power to not allow the equilibrium to shift. And existing institutions are part of that status quo. So you often need new organizations that allow fragile, potentially threatening ideas the chance to grow and germinate. So in a sense, these new organizational entities are more about providing a protective casing, cover, if you will, to allow new ideas that hopefully will eventually push against the status quo and set a new normal. That's our particular view of the world and our theory of change. And honestly, Carol, we consider it a success if one of our fellows' organizations merges into another organization or if it achieves its policy aims and say, you know what, good job, we've achieved it. We don't need to continue. We don't think organizations should exist in perpetuity if they're not still addressing a very prescient problem in the community.
One more quick question, Cheryl. You've recently been appointed the vice chair of the Commission of White House Fellowships. Congratulations. Tell me about that role and what your responsibilities will be in that position.
In 1997, I was appointed as a White House Fellow, and I had the great honor of spending a year serving as a special assistant to the Secretary of Labor, Alexis Herman. So that was another fellowship experience that had a profound impact on how I viewed the world, how I came to understand a citizen's relationship to the executive branch of government. So I've always felt indebted to the White House Fellowship Program for broadening my horizons. I was asked to serve as vice chair of the commission, and I had the great honor 2 weekends ago to interview 30 extraordinary, brilliant young people who really want to come to Washington, D.C. to serve this administration and their government for a year. So it's about the highest level of citizen service. So I had the very tough job of trying to choose between 30 brilliant people when we only selected 14 new White House fellows, and to really try to support the leadership of the program to provide top leadership to the new administration. So I'm just new to the commission, Carol, but I'm having a great time so far.
Well, we're lucky to have you. Cheryl, thanks for all the great work you're doing at Echoing Green, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Cheryl Dorsey is the president of Echoing Green. We have a link to more information about the projects of the 2009 fellows, and they are fascinating, on our website, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Gang violence is a notorious problem in cities around the world. A solution is not easy to come by, but in Los Angeles, one idea is making some progress. By simply keeping lights on at public parks and crime-prone areas, crime rates have shown a dramatic decline. A recent article from the New York Times looks at the program, now in its second year. Dubbed Summer Night Lights, the program doubled to 16 parks this year, keeping lights on and parks open until midnight. In 2008, the neighborhoods bordering the program's 8 parks saw 86% fewer homicides and a 17% reduction in gang-related crime. Having lights on later creates a place to go for young people who might otherwise be lured into gangs or getting into trouble, according to organizers. They've raised $1.4 million for the program, an amount the city has promised to match. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, an elevated leg of Interstate 10 has been a point of contention for more than 40 years. The elevated freeway drew a sharp division in the city and helped spur suburbanization that drained residents. Now, after years of complaining, planners are making visible steps to tear the freeway down. According to a recent article from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the city's Unified New Orleans plan is calling for the freeway's removal, and planners are behind the idea. But what's really pushing things forward is simple economics. Because the interstate is nearing the end of its lifespan, officials would need to invest tens of millions of dollars to refurbish it. The cheaper alternative, and one that is advocated in the city's new master plan, is to remove the freeway and retrofit surface streets to handle the overflow. Though some concerns over traffic persist, planners say that the success of freeway removals in other cities, like San Francisco, prove that the idea not only could work for New Orleans, but that the city will be better off because of it. And finally, New York City is also facing some questions about teardowns. But it's not an aging interstate that's plaguing New York. It's 138 half-finished or abandoned housing projects that developers have been forced to walk away from. Instead of busting out the wrecking ball, New York is trying to turn those lemon buildings into affordable housing lemonade. According to a recent article from the Architect's newspaper, the city's new housing asset renewal program is utilizing $20 million of city funds to help complete some projects and convert these once-market-rate units into affordable housing. The first infusion of city money is expected to rehab more than 400 units, and more money for the program is expected in the coming years. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, Catherine Vanyan joins us to talk about Velocity, an upcoming creative salon in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to examine the future of cities. Stay tuned for more Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, My City. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now, on with the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Catherine Vanyan is the managing partner of KVJ & Company and a top expert in strategic innovation. Catherine's work has linked emerging trends to responsible opportunities for growth in a number of fields, and she's worked to imagine the future of everything from medicine to motherhood. Her latest project, With CEOs for Cities, is a creative salon that looks to divine the future of cities. Catherine, you've done numerous projects on the future. You've looked at the future of work, the future of chemicals, the future of Major League Soccer. How do you gain insight into the future?
Well, it's interesting, and we actually use a lot of different methodologies, but I would say most important is to be open and observant. I think there are people that have that DNA to see the outliers in culture, to recognize when something looks different or feels different, or there's a new shop that opens up that is not just a new shop, but it represents something bigger. And to, first of all, see those opportunities and then understand why is it happening and why is it so magnetic? Why does it stick? Why are people in love with the peanut butter shop? By dissecting a bit of the human side of those opportunities, those outliers, you can start to make some interesting hypotheses. And then once we have really interesting hypotheses, we can start to ask the right questions. And they're usually questions that aren't being asked. They're usually out of the radar of people who don't focus on this work every day. And so many people are so focused on delivering for this quarter or for this year that they don't have a chance to really think about the future in a creative way.
What can you know with certainty about the future? And where are you making leaps of faith or inferences about the facts? I'm trying to understand what you feel like you can know with certainty when you think about the future. Or is it all speculation?
I think the future is not certain. The future is a canvas, and that we're all creating the future all of the time. But I do think that there are footprints that come from the past and lead into the future. And you can follow those footprints and make assumptions about where things are going, particularly if you understand some of the shifts in the track of footprints, if you can see them moving left or right and understand why that's happening. You have to understand such a broad spectrum of influencers, from technology to policy, scientific development. All of these things will influence our attitudes and behaviors and potentially put us on a different trajectory. Now, from a company perspective or a municipality perspective, trying to project that trajectory and find your opportunity on that spot is one element in the puzzle. The other is just going for that trajectory. Once you've figured out there is a trajectory that seems to be going in this direction, I actually really want to make that happen. So I'll start to identify opportunities out there and drive towards them. And that will be very magnetic in bringing people along that trajectory. That trajectory left alone might not produce anything. So that's where the creative process, I think, comes in terms of building the future. Any future is possible.
It's really an interesting way to think about it. So in part, you're projecting a trajectory, one that seems possible, and then saying, how do we, if we want to go for that, then how do we magnify that, amplify that, accelerate that? Is that a fair restatement?
Absolutely.
I know one of the methods that you use with trying to understand the future is the salon method. Talk a little bit about that, what a salon looks like, how it works, who participates, and what the outcome is.
The idea of a creative salon is really nothing new. It's a more or less a Medici-style salon, getting a diverse group of thinkers in the room together to tackle one theme or a set of questions related to a theme. And when we produce a creative salon, we're really looking for the most diverse group in terms of age and race, but also in terms of experience. We'll have mayors, CEOs, we'll have artists, filmmakers, video game makers, scientists, sociologists, evolutionary biologists, all working together to address a problem. And what they each bring such an amazing perspective and experience and success in their own field. When you can get those folks to all address the same kind of problem together, then really magical things start to happen.
You know that I attended the Aspen Ideas Festival last week, and the thought occurred to me there that there's an echo chamber effect in the conversations. The same people talking to each other and sort of reinforcing their own ideas when there's a whole world out there that's just trying to get up in the morning and feed the kids and get them off to school. It's like living a different parallel life. How do you prevent creative salons from becoming just that echo chamber or you know, reinforcing the way an elite group of people see the future and want to live, but normal people, if you will, or the vast majority of us just don't see anything in it for us?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think you have to look at the salon as part of a movement or part of that trajectory. So they can happen along the trajectory to help magnify that reality and crystallize that reality. And I think it requires a lot of leadership from the folks involved in that. They typically tend to be influencers in some way, and they're all doing their own experiments. So if a salon can be used to create a narrative that ties all of their individual experiments together, then the effort moves along that trajectory much faster and has more magnetism. More people will join it, more people will align with it if that group of experts is all moving to the same song.
Catherine, you're now working on a project on the future of cities. What are the questions that you hope to get to and hope to answer in this project?
Well, there are a lot of questions we hope to answer. I think first and foremost, we need to create that narrative that brings all of these isolated efforts and concerns across all cities in this country together. And that narrative needs to be focused on human needs and our emerging attitudes and behaviors. So what that means is our appetite for all things in general, is constantly in flux. And right now, we tend to have an appetite or an aspiration for suburbs, although that's changing. I think there are a lot of different groups that aspire to the city already. And what we want to do is create a vision or a narrative for cities that's so compelling that as our emerging attitudes and behaviors evolve, more people see the city as the place that they want to be, the community they want to be a part of, the opportunity of a lifetime. And so creating that narrative is the first big question, if you will. And I think it's broken down into a number of human elements. And we're taking an approach with human needs. We're focusing on survival, belonging, thriving or development, and ultimately self-actualization, which we're calling reward. So understanding why people do what they do and in the context of the city is very important, and we'll develop this narrative. Now, then there are a lot of interesting questions that will help create the ideal city. And the ideal city is different for every city, but there are some solutions or experiments that are applicable across the board and or could be customized. For instance, I think one of the questions for me is about post-consumption culture. And I think, you know, the economy going bust has changed how we shop and the amount that we're buying and what have you. But that's not, I don't believe that that's a new thing or a blip in culture that will jump right back. I think we've been building towards this for a long time. Technology has brought such awareness of our products and where they come from and how they were built and what the implications for the environment are, or, you know, my children's health and well-being and all of that. So I think that people are pretty fed up with companies in general, and they don't want to buy. And what they do buy, they're very thoughtful about. And I don't think that's going to change after the economy improves. I think they'll be even more conscious. So if the typical street within a city is filled with retail shops, then what happens when people stop buying? What are the new jobs? What are the new work styles? What are the new industries and experiences? How will the city find its funding? And is there a new business model around, as a social business for cities, some kind of break-even model where they're actually providing services or, you know, working with entrepreneurs in partnership to create a new genre of industry?
You're talking about a post-consumption society, and I certainly agree that there are big questions associated around reduced spending, reduction in sales tax for cities, use of leisure time. You know, so there are lots of things that could change. On the other hand, you see the most profitable, predictable retailer today is Walmart. It's a little bit hard to reconcile this notion of post-consumption society, thoughtfulness, sourcing, et cetera, with the success of Walmart. So how do you, in an exploration of the future of cities, how do you reconcile those seemingly contradictory things?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think first, we're looking again at outliers and we're not looking at the mainstream. So if we're going to invent for tomorrow, we have to start looking at luxury and looking at new patterns of behavior. So an easy reaction to an economic crisis today, the answer is Walmart. But I also think there are other new things happening. There are more people sharing clothes or passing them on. I think people are interested in reusing. People are going to try to get old vegetables from supermarkets and use them, and there's a movement around that. I think there are a lot of interesting solutions that may not be practical on a mainstream level, but that's the source for new business models or new ideas. And the other thing that I'll say is I think a lot of it will come down to experience. When people have the money again to spend, I think they'll be more thoughtful. I think the experience of shopping, what they'll be actually purchasing, will be more of an experience. So Walmart could be the answer. It could be that that kind of experience, in, out, cheap, is the right thing. And it could be that the Weston model of the heavenly bed, selling this experience, come stay for a night and then take your bed home with you, that might be the future. So we've really got to dissect and understand what people on on the edge, the influencers, the early adopters, the creators are doing, and think about what would ultimately make sense for the mainstream if they had more access to it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine Vagnon. We're talking about her work on the future of cities. Catherine talked about using creative salons to bring together leaders from diverse fields. So I ask her, when high-powered people of different backgrounds work together, do they create together or do they lean on their own expertise?
Oh, they're absolutely creating together. And I think it's important to really think of the salon as a group of participants. There's no audience. And they may be people that were also at TED as speakers, but they're not coming here to speak pontificate about what they already know and what the solutions are that they've already discovered themselves and try to convince the rest of the group. Instead, they're really focused on questions that require a solution that's developed in groups of three or five experts. So it could be a filmmaker sitting with a psychologist and a mayor and a CEO, and they've all got to come up with a solution that makes sense from their perspective. Now, it could be that one of them has a solution already and they get everyone else to buy into that solution, but it would be an interesting proof point if four experts from that diverse makeup would agree that that's the right solution.
To some extent, that raises the question of creativity. How do you prepare people to be creative in a session like the Creative Salon or any other?
One method is trying to be thoughtful about the personalities that come into the room. And it is like planning a dinner party. You've got to make sure that the people you've got there have the tendency to interact with each other and to be open-minded and willing to play. There are people all along the spectrum in terms of their working styles and what have you and communication styles. So it's okay if that one is more expansive and another is more focused. And so once you've designed the salon to have the right kinds of participants, then you start to design the experience of the salon. And for me, one of the most important parts is the element of surprise. So we design the conversation to be different than what most of these folks experience on a day-to-day basis. It should be curious and inventive and fun and meaningful. The questions should be thoughtful. They should align with the questions that keep these folks up at night and get them out of bed in the morning. I mean, I could get into more specific techniques. One of them is urban spelunking, where we take a group of people, usually in groups of five or seven, rather intimate, on a field trip through a city and show them some of the most inventive businesses out there or most interesting experiences. Sometimes that's something that is related to customer service or a new kind of product. Every time we go on an urban spelunking experience, it is designed with a theme in mind. This does a couple different things. First, all of the participants tend to be more relaxed and establish a personal relationship with the other folks on the trip. And it is fun, and it's not something that they've experienced typically before, certainly not with the same group of people. And the questions that we're asking are also designed to get folks to be creative along the way. So it's not just like going to a museum and you look at something and, you know, you're sort of stuck in your head, or you might mention something to a friend nearby. But this is really, each location is selected to be provocative and surprising and to get people to start talking about that place and its relevance for the task at hand. So it's not just out there. It's really something that could be relevant for, in this case, cities.
What do you see, Catherine, as the tangible outcomes of this creative salon on the future of cities?
The first outcome will be this narrative. And I think that's really important because all of the experiments and activities in the world, all disconnected, may be interesting. But I think what we're ready for this historic moment in time is a new vision for the good life. And that good life is centered in the city. And for all of our great efforts and experiments to create that experience of the good life in the city, we need one strong story that will drive us towards it, that everyone understands and says, aha, I get it, and that's a beautiful vision, and that's what I want. So the first deliverable is a really strong narrative. And the second would be a series of experiments that really make sense to build that vision for the good life. And those could be anything from talent solutions, how to attract and develop talent in your city. It could be related to transportation or infrastructure. The experiments will also serve human needs. So we want to make sure that people can survive in a way, for instance, feel safe in a city without it feeling like a police state. So survival is served and actually feels good. And with respect to thriving, that people feel like they're learning all the time in the city and they have access to opportunities and they can self-direct and find ways to achieve their own success in the city.
Well, go with me then backwards. You have a narrative. You have what you call experiments that will drive that narrative. How do the experiments then add back up to the narrative? In other words, how do you prevent this from becoming just a series of, okay, let's do green roofs and let's do, you know, the smart car and let's do, I mean, in other words, how do you sort of marry back the experiments to the breadth of the narrative?
First of all, this salon is entitled Velocity, and this Velocity program is not just a salon, it's a movement. And that means there are a lot of activities beyond and before the salon to make sure that the story proliferates and is constantly being injected with new creativity from citizens and mayors and other stakeholders in cities as it grows. So we see that the narrative is the thing that sticks, that has to be communicated, that people begin to adopt and aspire to, and that the experiments make it real. So if you think about constellations in the sky, you don't want 100 stars or a gazillion stars out there all twinkling on their own. What you really want is a galaxy or a constellation, a collection of stars that tie everything together. So this narrative will tie it together in a way that makes it visible to more folks. Instead of seeing one star, you see the collection.
I love your analogy. It's quite useful. Let me ask you one more question, Catherine. You're a New Yorker. You and your family, two kids, a husband, live in Brooklyn. How does your experience as a New Yorker inform your work when you think about the future of cities?
Oh, wow. First of all, New York is just an amazing city with so much creativity and opportunity. I'm often told by others that I have to forget that I'm a New Yorker to do any of this work whatsoever, because we live in a place that's very unique. On the other hand, I feel that all of this experience here in New York is valuable and it has to be put in context. And I'm very fortunate to have that experience. And I recognize other people have other phenomenal experience from other cities. So first, I think it's important to recognize your own context and how that does influence and use it as a springboard for innovation, but not to assume that everybody else in the world wants the same thing, has access to the same thing, but that New York in and of itself has its own situation. And secondly, it's been very real for me as I've had to make the decision over the last year, really, do we stay or do we go? And going, and this is primarily driven by having my daughter entering school age and trying to understand what that means in New York in terms of public education. It's been an interesting process thinking about the friends, the community, the work, the access to opportunity here, and then getting down to some real basics around providing the best education for my daughter possible in a public school system. We've explored going to smaller cities, which I think is a great option for a lot of folks if they're looking for something a little more intimate. But ultimately, we have decided to stay in the city specifically because of all of the opportunity and excitement and activity here. We use the museums. We take the kids to see the ballet and just to have the experience on the street with so much diversity, to raise children that are essentially colorblind. I don't know if you can say that, but it's, you know, they recognize that people have different colors, but they're perfectly comfortable with anyone of any race. And they really don't have bias that I think in some places there is. All of the pros and cons of this city in particular are very real for us right now. And at the end of the day, we said, this is what we want as a family unit. This is our aspiration and our dream. And we want to raise healthy, happy kids in this city. And from that perspective, that's really helped me think through what are the issues. What are some of the questions that we'll have to address at Velocity? Affordability is certainly one of them. Financial frugality, access to information, places, things, people, access and availability of school, of a good public school education. So, you know, I do use it as one lens and then rely on a lot of people from a lot of other cities to understand their lens.
Well, we will hear more about Velocity. Catherine, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Catherine Vanyan is the managing partner of KVJ & Company. She joined us to talk about Velocity, a creative salon on the future of cities. The Velocity Salon will take place in Grand Rapids, Michigan, September 14th and 15th. Her interview was engineered by Andrew Krivanis. That's it for this week's show, but there's more Smart City if you go to our website, smartcityradio.com. You can listen to archive shows, subscribe to our podcast, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer, and he says happy birthday, Matilda Jane. I'm Carol Coletta.